Hello and welcome to our 2019 Outlook podcast featuring Guy Foster, the Bruins Head of Fund Research, and a cameo appearance from David Davis, MP. Please enjoy, but first here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. To confirm an investment's suitability, please contact your financial advisor. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. For further information, please refer to our conflicts policy, which is available on request or via our website at www.bruin.co.uk. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the final Bruin podcast of 2018, and in that context this podcast will be discussing our views with Guy Foster, our Head of Research for 2019. I think the key challenges that questions we get asked in investment is, what is the asset class you most prefer for 2019, for the year ahead? So we'll look at whether we like equities or bonds more, and then beneath that we'll look at whether we want to have exposure to the developing world over emerging markets, and then within the developing world whether US or Europe is the trade to go for. Now, of course, there's lots of other news going on in the markets at the moment. Clearly we're suffering a lot of volatility, and I think the equity bond conversation will cover that quite neatly. But of course, Brexit news is ever present and seems to be cranking up. Indeed, the narrative currently is that the government is now stepping up its no-deal preparations. And this is a great opportunity for us to revisit a podcast we recorded just a few months ago with none other than David Davis, the former Secretary of State for exiting the European Union. Now, one of the questions that Guy posed to him was, what are the level of preparedness? What is the level of preparedness from the UK government in relation to a no deal? And what was cited was an example, actually, in relation to Dover-Calais and how that issue may be overcome in the face of a no deal. And here is what David Davis said on that matter.
20% of the throughput could move to other ports.
To Folkestone or something.
Tilbury, Felixstowe, Hull, Ipswich, all those ports. And on the other side, of course, Rotterdam, Zeebrugge, Antwerp and so on. But if you can change the mode, you can get 40%.
Okay, this is a great opportunity now to bring in Guy Foster, our Head of Research, to assess that comment and tackle all the other issues I mentioned at the top of the podcast. Guy, thanks so very much for tearing yourself away from the chocolate advent calendar. What do you make of that comment that David Davis said there about our ability to handle the no-deal outcome?
Well, of course, David Davis at the time was speaking before this week's cabinet meeting. At this week's cabinet meeting, it was decided that the no-deal Brexit preparations should take some sort of prominence. And I think what you get there from somebody who is obviously very much on the Brexiteering wing of the party is an expression of just how much thought has already gone into it, which is quite a lot, but at the same time how difficult the challenges of preparing for a no deal are likely to be. So, you know, obviously he is talking about one crossing, Dover-Calais, saying, well, we can potentially deflect 20% of throughput under the circumstances where we can change it from road to rail, or, for example, or other changes in mode. And then it could maybe get to 40%. Now, that's some pretty big caveats there, because I think that transition to a different form is remarkably difficult. And shifting to another port doesn't necessarily guarantee to any extent that that other port is going to be in a better position, because all of the ports, pretty much all of the ports that he's mentioned there, are obviously members of the European Union. And so you're talking about having, in a no-deal scenario, a more significant barrier between the UK and all of those ports. And then, of course, the final point is that 40% is still not a very big number. You know, it's still, most people will realise, less than half. So there are definite challenges to the no-deal preparations in terms of what the government can do. But I think to a more meaningful extent, it's like what the rest of the economy can do, because they need to keep that trade flowing in order that companies that have very integrated supply chains with Europe are able to keep operating. Now, we know we've done here our no-deal preparations as a service-orientated financial business. You know, it's not the biggest challenge for us. For a manufacturer or something with one of those integrated supply chains, it'd be very significant. But wherever you do it, you have to dedicate quite a lot of time and resource to the making those efforts. And in large companies, you obviously make sure you find that resource and you do what you can do. So it might mean stockpiling goods, but the challenge there is that, you know, most companies operate on just-in-time processes, which mean that they don't have the space to stockpile a great deal more. Are they going to build another warehouse or something like that? The reality is that it's impossible to do in any short time period, and it's just such a change to your business model, such a big drain on your working capital, as well as the investment that you would require for something that you've been led to believe that you aren't going to need. You know, that even large companies...
And that is still the aspiration of the government, is to strike a deal, isn't it? From almost all quarters of the House.
Yes. Well, I mean, it sort of was until this ambiguous cabinet meeting in which no-deal preparations, you know, still the ambition to pass the government's deal, but no-deal preparations are now the primary course of action. But, you know, even beyond those large businesses that have the resources, I think it's often difficult to comprehend just how important small businesses are. I mean, just because of maths, almost all businesses are small businesses. 99% of businesses in the UK are small. They account for half of all employment in the UK and about a third of all turnover. And for the majority of those, you just can't create a new department or a new special project to work out how you're going to deal with a no-deal Brexit, particularly not in short order. So it is, at the very least, it's very difficult for the government to know how prepared the economy is. And I think it's reasonable to assume that the state of preparedness is quite poor, and that it would be, under any circumstances, incredibly difficult to get the economy ready for that if it wasn't 100% sure that it was coming.
Okay, now there's lots of other interesting things we've got to talk about, and you can get sort of stuck on Brexit, but just to wrap this up, the government would presumably, on the basis of a no deal, even though it looks challenging, they would sort of open up their fiscal plans, and would there be some, there's sort of lots of comments about a managed no deal versus a disorderly no deal. You know, do we want to, just trying to sort of placate concerns that actually no deal may not be this sort of Armageddon that some are talking about?
Yeah, well, I think the truth is that nobody really knows, and that there will definitely be stresses in the economy, and that they are likely to be significant. But how significant is simply really just, it's impossible for anybody to know, for precisely that point, you know, that it's just so difficult to dig into this huge number of individual businesses who might be impacted by a no-deal Brexit.
And therefore, it is still our conclusion, despite the very opaque outlook on which route we finally descend upon, but that no deal remains a low probability event in our mind.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely, that has to be your conclusion. I mean, the other outcome from the cabinet meeting this week was obviously a private cabinet meeting, but we all seem to know exactly what was said by whom and when during that meeting. The other conclusion is that the Prime Minister herself is not willing to countenance any other option than her deal. So it's impossible to tell whether she is more adamantly against a soft Brexit than a no deal or a second referendum than a no deal, because even in private she seems completely relentless in her opposition to all of those outcomes, leaving only the deal that she didn't send to Parliament for a vote last week.
Okay, right, well, let's move on to markets for 2019. And the opening question will be, you know, do equities look more attractive than bonds? And I'm sure in the context of this answer, we might want to reference the very challenging quarter we've experienced and indeed the heightened levels of volatility that seem to be ongoing.
I think that equities certainly do look more attractive than bonds going into 2019. I mean, what has happened this year is, to a large extent, what we expected to happen, that we had strong growth, and yet we had equity market volatility. The equity market volatility, I think it's reasonable to say, has been a bit more significant and has lasted a bit longer than we had anticipated. But it's reflecting at the moment that the cause is the withdrawal of liquidity that we've experienced, and the prompt for it has been a fairly modest reduction in growth expectations for 2019, and I think a lingering fear from some investors that the end of the cycle might have moved closer to us. Now, from our perspective, actually, ironically, I think we think the end of the cycle has moved further away, that it's harder now to see a recession coming in 2019 than it would have been, for example, at the beginning of 2018.
Okay, so growth conditions have only modestly moderated, but equity markets are getting an absolute hiding. What is your sort of rational explanation for that? And does that now leave equities looking outstandingly cheap or modestly cheap?
So the markets are a reflection of the opportunity cost of investing. And so earlier in this year, we saw the markets sell off because bond yields were going up. And they are still higher in most markets than they were, or in some markets than they were at the beginning of the year. Therefore, bonds looked a little bit more attractive, and equities were offering a return that was not materially changed relative to that. So as it started to look like bond yields were going to go up and up and up, and we heard endless scare stories about how high bond yields were going to go, then it was sort of made sense that people might be switching or anticipating a switch from equities into bonds, not valuing equities quite so positively. You know, what's happened more recently is that we've seen bond yields start to come back down, and what that is a reflection of the fact that the inflation trajectory is weaker. If inflation trajectory is weaker, then the bond yield doesn't need to go so high. But there are still a lot of bonds being sold as a result of the Federal Reserve pulling back on its quantitative easing program, or quantitatively tightening, as people
call
it.
Putting bonds back into the market now.
Effectively selling bonds back into the market. And the fact that the US is running a big fiscal deficit, so it's also putting a lot of bonds into the market. So that just means that for all of the liquidity flood in the market, more of it is being sucked up in order to maintain bond yields at that level that reflects investors' expectations for inflation and interest rates. That means there's less of that liquidity washing around for stocks. Now, we think that means that that changes the volatility of stocks, which is what we're experiencing at the moment, but it shouldn't really change the valuation of them. You know, ultimately the valuation of, just like the valuation of a bond is what you expect inflation to do, and the valuation of a company is what you expect its earnings to be. And so you see a very, so as you get less liquidity in the market, then you start to have more volatility around that earnings expectation. And when there is a small shift in growth expectations, then you can see stock prices depart from those fundamental expectations more dramatically. I think that's what we have seen in the final quarter of 2018.
So the earnings profile of these businesses still looks decent, but the withdrawal of liquidity means volatility around that valuation, and that's probably something that's not likely to, that dynamic isn't about to change anytime soon.
No, it looks like, I mean, certainly that was the message from the Federal Reserve yesterday, was talking about quantitative tightening being on autopilot. So that means that this kind of heightened volatility is something that we should expect to happen. But that, you know, we should stress that means a greater sensitivity to changes in economic news. So it's as possible and as likely that you have dramatic shifts higher as dramatic shifts lower.
Okay, right. Well, let's tackle the next question. But perhaps no matter which question I ask, it comes back to the Fed and the dollar. But you know, emerging markets, I mean, a lot of equities have sort of cheapened up. Certainly the US is not as expensive as it was, but emerging markets seem to be the standout cheap asset class. Do you think EMs will do better than DM in 2000, the emerging markets will do better than developed markets in 2019?
Yeah, that's our expectation. I mean, I think the most important thing for that dynamic is what happens to the dollar, and it is really interesting to see, because we're anticipating a year in which the dollar is weak by the end of it, but at the moment you would still feel that the risks are skewed to the upside for the dollar, and the reason for that is just because of the differential in growth rates between the US and everywhere outside the US. So once you start to see some stabilization in growth, some improvement in growth, particularly in Europe, that's when I think you're likely to see investors really kind of lose faith in the dollar, following its its profligate issuance of new dollar-based securities.
And the explanation, you think, for more recent, very recent actually, EM outperformance of developed markets?
Well, I mean, I think some of it is valuation based, yeah. And some of it reflects the fact that the dollar hasn't rolled off yet, but it is showing clear signs of fatigue. No better example of this comes than yesterday's Federal Reserve meeting, when it was a hawkish meeting from the Fed. They talked about having more rate hikes in 2019 than the market was expecting, or than the market believes. So the dollar rose by 0.5% on a trade weighted basis. But as we record this 12 hours later, it's already given back all of those gains. So I think that just goes to show how much fatigue there is around the dollar, and I think that's one of the factors that is helping investors to think that there may be better opportunities in Asia and emerging markets.
So the dollar is sort of forming a top, but we're waiting for stabilization of growth in sort of Europe and I guess China before we start sort of making louder noises about that move out of developed markets into emerging markets.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we've been edging in that direction, but particularly with Asia, but it's obviously the case that you have got a very big risk to that story in the form of China and the fact and China's economic weakness, and the early part of 2019 is likely to be a particularly difficult one as a result of the fact that some orders have been brought forward to try and anticipate tariffs, US-Chinese tariffs, that have since been postponed, possibly cancelled. But nevertheless, the fact that the orders have already been brought through means there should be quite a significant soft patch in terms of China's exports to the US in early 2019. And that, I think, is a big risk to sentiment around the region.
Okay, so we'll move on to the sort of final question, and I guess this will have many similar traits to the developed market, emerging market trade, is whether North America looks more appealing than Europe. I guess Europe, with its integration, closer integration with emerging market fortunes, means that there is some caution in the shorter term, but maybe towards the back end of the year, or the second half of the year, Europe looks more appealing, or indeed have I got it totally wrong, Guy?
No, I think that's right. The question on the timing is obviously the most important one, but I think, you know, there are a whole host of trades that would be positive if this negative dollar view starts to come to fruition, and that also hinge upon things like a stabilization and recovery in European growth. And whilst we talk about the risks to China, so China is such a big market for Europe. Europe generates so little of its own domestic demand now that it is really reliant on the US and China stroke the larger Asian region to try and provide the sort of marginal demand that prompts a recovery in growth. But I guess we have had, was also this week, the resolution of the apparent resolution of the Italian European Union budget standoff. And we've also heard last week that France is going to be having a more expansionary budget in response to its yellow vest protests, and I'm sure that was not irrelevant in terms of the resolution that Italy then reached with the EU as well. So there's a bit more of a sort of positive fiscal story in Europe. The UK also a bit more fiscally expansive than had been assumed. And the big story, I think, that the support for all regions is the dramatic fall in the oil price over the last few months, because that will provide a stimulus to consumers and company and businesses outside of the oil manufacturing industry all around the world. And in many ways, I think this feels a lot like 2016, where you have monetary policy uncertainty, you had a weak oil price. Initially, it's treated as quite negative by the market, but ultimately, of course, it's shown to be a tremendous boon to economic activity and set up the stage for a very strong equity rally. And that was something that's highly reminiscent, really, of what we might be experiencing in 2019.
And I guess, I mean, it's supposed to be transient, but it takes some of the pressure off central banks in their ambitions to tighten policy, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, that's something that that Jay Powell mentioned yesterday. The inflation outlook gives them an opportunity to be patient. And, you know, we started off by talking about how the market is worried about recession risks coming towards us, but actually it looks more to us as if recession risks are shifting further away. And so the oil fall in the oil price is one of the factors driving that. Fall in long-term bond yields in the US, which means mortgage rates are coming down, whereas they had really quite significantly increased during 2018, is another factor that just supports US economic growth rather than inhibiting it.
Okay, so the summary is that no deal Brexit is avoided, so there is modest upside in sterling next year. Developed equities look like a better asset class than bonds. Developed markets in North America look like the more appealing asset class at the moment, but as we move through 2019, and should we get some growth stabilisation out of China and Europe, then we'll be looking to transition across from into both of those asset classes. Is that a neat summary, Guy? Have I missed something?
I think that would be our anticipation, yes. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thanks. Thanks, Guy. Thanks to our listeners for all your support in 2018. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. We welcome feedback. Do let us know what you think on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whatever medium you listen to this platform through. But other than that, have a fantastic Christmas and holiday season, and all the very best for 2019.